I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. In spite of what you may have heard, even monks need to eat. They just can't be fasting all the time. Sometimes they dine on more than just bread and water, maybe a little fish. When monks do partake of a wholesome repast, this often takes place in a communal space called a refectory. And in a refectory, if your monastery likes to decorate, a monk may very well have a feast for the eyes as well as a feast for the belly, which is to say that many a refectory in former times was adorned with artwork depicting, who knows why, a banquet scene. I guess that's thematically on target. Well, we are about to hear the story of a grand painting from the Italian Renaissance, a painting that once graced the wall of the refectory of the world-renowned monastery and church of San Giorgio Maggiore in Venice. This painting story is in part delicious and in part distasteful because it's the story of a plundered piece of art. The painting did not stay in Venice and is not there now, and therein lies a tale worth telling. Here with us to tell the story is Cynthia Saltzman, a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal, winner of a 2017 Guggenheim Fellowship. Saltzman is author of a new book titled Plunder, Napoleon's Theft of Veronese's Feast. She's on the line with us now. Cynthia Saltzman, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Marcus. It's a pleasure to be here.
Just moments ago, as I was chatting with you, you told me of a behind-the-scenes story. I think I want to start there because it's literally behind the scene of this painting. You've been behind the painting. How can that be?
Well, the painting is today in the Louvre, and it hangs across from the Mona Lisa. And it is such a huge painting. It's 33 feet wide, 22 feet tall, that when they most recently renovated the gallery that it's in, instead of hanging the painting on the wall, they hung it from the French curators at the Louvre, hung it from a scaffolding, and they had cut a large rectangular hole in the wall of the gallery, and they inserted the painting into that hole. And the gold frame, it has a huge gold frame, is attached to the wall. It is not attached to the painting. And I went to the Louvre. The curator was wonderful, and he let me go to the Louvre at night when nobody was there, to see the painting in an empty room with a Mona Lisa and this painting, and then to go in this very thin room that they have on the behind the painting on the other side of the gallery where I could see the back of the painting.
Well, we all know what to call the Mona Lisa. We call it the Mona Lisa. What do we call this much larger canvas that's in the facing off where Mona Lisa's smiling?
This is called the Wedding Feast at Cana. And it was, as you said, for these refectories, they would be decorated with a biblical feast. Most famously, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper in Milan, biblical feast. And this is a biblical feast. It's in contrast, it's the most festive of biblical feasts. It's the wedding at which Jesus changes water into wine.
Now, if you would, aside from the immensity of this artwork, would you tell us what it depicts beyond this? I mean, in terms of through the artist's eyes, it's not really biblical architecture. It's not, from the Levant. This is very much a European scene.
No, what's wonderful is that Veronese set this biblical supper in 16th century Venice, and he fills it with 130 figures. Many of them are life-size, and they're wearing silks and other fabrics for which Venice was famous and that produced a lot of Venice's wealth. And he sets this table, huge table, on a terrace. Behind it is another terrace. And he puts it with this soaring Renaissance architecture. So it's in addition to being a biblical feast, it's really a portrait of Venetian society.
But is that society populated by commoners in the painting? Are we seeing noble people? Are we seeing high society? Or is it more like the wedding feast at Cana?
No, it's Venetian elite society, the Venetian aristocrats, the Venetian nobility. They're also, I think, on the right side of the painting, on the right side of the table, there are monks from San Giorgio Maggiore. On the left side, there are guests in exotic costumes. And these are Venice was an incredibly cosmopolitan place. It was a trading center, and these appear to be people who were visitors from the Middle East.
Now, there's something. There's a connection to the realm of Palestine, actually, there. If somebody was actually in town from out of town, I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And they don't, you know, the scholars don't really know. Were these people living in Venice, or were they just there for 2 weeks making trades and, you know, doing business and then going home? This is the kind of thing. It's so fascinating. They have so many figures. And it's in the center of the painting is a group of musicians. And one of the musicians is supposed to be a self-portrait of Veronese. But what's important is that the musicians are center stage, and that Veronese is really emphasizing the place of music in the life of Venice, and more broadly, the place of art. And then there are wonderful dogs. He loved dogs. And there's one of them is looking at a cat. So it's very humorous also.
You know, with a canvas this large, with all of that activity at a grand event like a wedding feast, sounds to me like you could spend hours scanning over this canvas and still not see it at all. Is it fair to say this is one of the busiest scenes in Renaissance painting?
I think that's right. I mean, you could go to the Sistine Chapel. There's very busy scenes, but yes. yeah, it's amazing. And I think that's it was very influential on French painting, and I think it's one of the reasons. There's a lot of things going on, not just one thing, but many. And it's got absolutely beautiful colors. The Phoenicians were famous for their colors because they had exploited oil on canvas. And it's also amazing because it shows Veronese's ability to create the illusion of reality. So if you go to the refectory, you can go to the refectory today. It's been renovated, and they have actually a digital reproduction of this painting. And you can get the sense that Veronese made it appear as though it covered the entire end wall of the room. It's a very plain white room designed by the Renaissance architect Andrea Palladio. And Veronese created the illusion that the room opens up and that this feast is taking place on a terrace just outside.
An outdoor feast then, yeah.
An outdoor feast, yeah. What's amazing also is that it was commissioned by the abbot of San Giorgio Maggiore, and he insisted that Veronese use only the finest colors, including ultramarine, which was the most expensive and beautiful blue. And the sky is used, indeed, conservators analyzed the paint, and he did. He used ultramarine, and that's one of the reasons the colors are still so beautiful.
I was hoping you would talk about the color ultramarine, because therein lies a tale. I did not realize that adjective, ultramarine, is a geographical explanation of where the pigment comes from.
I know. Isn't it wonderful? It means beyond the sea. Ultramarine is made of powdered lapis lazuli, and it came from Afghanistan. The Venetians imported it. And Venice was – the demand for pigments and dyes was so great in Venice that it was a center of pigments and dyes, and they had all these fantastic colors.
Well, so far we've been talking about the painting itself, the artifact, the physical canvas and the paints on it and what it depicts. A huge, huge part of this story isn't just about what it looks like, but how it got to France in the first place and Napoleon's hand in that. It's time for us now to start talking about that chapter. If this was painted all those centuries ago, and if it was positioned in the refectory at San Giorgio Maggiore in Venice all those years, why did it leave Italy?
It left Italy because Napoleon's troops tore it down from the wall of the monastery in 1797. Napoleon was on his very first Italian campaign. He was fighting the Austrians in Italy, because the Austrians had for over a century occupied the Duchy of Milan. And so he marches across Italy, and in the various, as he defeats these various Italian states, he insists on taking works of art and putting them into the terms of the treaty. He wanted to march across. Venice was, at the time, went the Venetian Republic went all the way west to Milan, and Napoleon wanted to march across Venetian territory to get to Vienna to fight to, because after he had defeated the Austrians in Milan. And so when he arrived in Venice, he captured it, and he insisted on that the Venetians hand over 20 paintings. And this was number 6 on the list.
All those paintings taken by Napoleon back to Paris, I would say that they qualify as spoils of war, and yet there's kind of a little legalese going on here where he kind of justifies it in the signed treaty. Explain that, because to me that just seems kind of bogus.
Well, the Duke of Wellington agreed with you. And in 1815, after he defeated Napoleon, he insisted that the French king return all those works of art Napoleon had taken and put in the Louvre. But yes, it had been the policy of the French when they were fighting the Austrians, even before Napoleon was on this campaign. They had been fighting the Austrians in the Austrian Netherlands, and they took these great Rubens altarpieces back to Paris. But Napoleon really made this policy his own, in part by putting these works of art in the terms of the treaty. And the French had argued that the French Republic, because it was a democracy, or there was no longer a king, that they were the only worthy nation to possess these great works of art. But I think that it shows, when he put them in the terms of the treaty, he was very pragmatic. He recognized that this was a very controversial thing to do, to take works of art. It was no longer the norm in the 18th century to do that. But he didn't want any questions asked.
Would you tell us about the actual transport of this canvas? Because I said there's a bit of a distasteful aspect to this, beyond just the fact that it was plundered. It was cut in half?
Well, it wasn't cut in half to get there. But what's fascinating is that all but one of the paintings in Venice, they were Renaissance paintings, where most Renaissance paintings were created for a particular site, the way this one was. So in order to get it, even though it was canvas, it's ironic. One of the things about canvas is that canvases can be easily moved, much more so than paintings on wooden panels. And yet this painting was never intended to be moved. And to get it down from the wall, they had to remove the nails around the periphery, but the painting had been attached with three rows of nails across the front, and when they pulled it down, they created three rows of holes that all had to be fixed when it got to Paris. And then when it got to Paris, the French decided that the painting needed to be lined. That means they needed to put a new canvas on the back of the old. The canvas is the most fragile. The actual fabric is the most fragile part of a painting on canvas. And in order to do that, they decided it was too big to line and painting. You put a new painting on the back of the old, and then you attach it with glue, and you have to iron the painting to make the glue.
Okay, I kind of want you to stop right there, because this is worse than how sausage is made.
They try not to do it line paintings anymore. But anyway, they decided it was too big to reline or to line, and so they cut the painting in two and had made two separate paintings. They lined those, and then they put them on two separate stretchers. And so there were two horizontal. The painting was in two. There were two horizontal paintings, and they hung one above the other.
So when you were there looking at it from behind on that late night when nobody else was, were you able to look and detect and see actually where it was stitched back together, or was it too high up in the air?
No, you can't see that, because in the 1850s, this solution of putting it on two stretchers and then covering up the tiny gap in between them didn't work very well. And you see in the Louvre records, they're always trying to fill the gap, put putty and paint, putty and paint. And in the 1850s, the person who was in charge of French Museum said, we're going to put this on one, we're going to line it now with one piece of canvas. And so they put another new lining on it, and it's just all since the 1850s, and it's been in one piece. And that, but the what you see on the back is that one that new canvas they put on in the 1850s.
Well, if you can't see it from the back, can you detect where that line would be from the front?
Yes, you can, but they've really done a good job. Most paintings at the time were created by putting together strips of linen, because linen only came in strips that were about a meter wide. So in order to make this painting, you had to have six separate strips of linen. And you can see the seams of those six separate strips. And they had actually cut one of those seams, so it doesn't look that different.
Okay, okay.
You can see that in the front if you look at, you know, the light raking over the front of the picture. But you can see that with many Renaissance pictures. It's interesting.
Well, let's go back to this Duke of Wellington that you mentioned. It sounds to me like he was responsible for the return of essentially patrimony to Italy, right? Many of these paintings went from the Louvre back to their original point of origin, with the exception of this one painting?
This is the first Italian campaign. In 1796, 1797, the French took about 230 paintings. They also took 80 sculptures from Rome. And they returned about 115 of those paintings. So this painting didn't go back because the French resisted giving things back. The curators of the Louvre did not want to. And they argued that if they sent this Veronese's wedding feast, this huge painting, if they rolled it up again, it might damage and possibly destroy it. And because at the time, Venice was not independent, it was under, Austria was in control of Venice. It was up to the Austrians to get this painting back. And this, when the French made this argument, they put it in a letter, and that letter was given to the Austrian emperor. It was in Paris, and he was leaving that day. And the French said, we will give you another painting in exchange, or we will give Venice another painting. We will give St. Giorgio Maggiore another painting. And the Austrian emperor agreed to it. So that's why this painting didn't go back. Many other paintings had been sent to provincial museums. They were not in the Louvre. And I think it was just because it was difficult to go get them.
Cynthia Saltzman, I want to talk with you a little bit more about what was in this for Napoleon himself, why he was so invested in procuring these artworks. We're going to chat with that after a short break here on our show. We're visiting with Cynthia Saltzman, who is author of Plunder, Napoleon's Theft of Veronese's Feast. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. And often we will investigate the world of art, and this story is about art, yes, but also about politics and plunder. We have with us Cynthia Saltzman, who is author of Plunder, Napoleon's Theft of Veronese's Feast. That feast, by the way, is a famed painting in the Louvre today, which originated in Venice. It depicts the wedding scene at Cana, the biblical scene with Jesus in the center of the painting, and the setting for it all is not anywhere near Jerusalem. It's actually very much a scene in Venice, a Venetian scene. Cynthia Saltzman, I was going to ask you about Napoleon. Was he really into art, or was he more into symbols of power, I'm guessing?
Yes, he was into symbols of power. I think he understood very much the power of great art. Because when in Italy, in this first campaign, when Antoine Gros paints his portrait, and he paints a wonderful portrait, and it's one of the very first portraits ever painted of him, of Napoleon. Before this, nobody really had any idea what he looked like. And Gros paints a portrait of this young soldier in the smoke of battle, and he idealizes him, and he really makes him appear to be someone who could be the savior of France. And Napoleon immediately gave Gros funds so that he could have prints of that portrait made. And he also, I think, understood the same thing happened when he saw David's portrait of him, a famous portrait of him on the rearing horse going over the Alps. He ordered three copies. He hadn't commissioned the portrait. It had been commissioned by the Spanish king, but he immediately understood this was a great portrait, and would set the image of him images we still have today.
I'm wondering if you can maybe reconcile a couple of different concepts here, because it's one thing for somebody as powerful as Napoleon who is very much got his autocratic tendencies. It's one thing for him to go after the collection of art. But then you mentioned that early on there was something, some kind of justification about the idea of the spirit of a democratic people or, you know, where after the French Revolution, only the French people, I think you said, would somehow be justified in having collections of this grandeur. How do you bring those two strands, those two arguments together? Napoleon, is he just nominally saying that these artworks are to celebrate the grandeur of the French people? Or because it seems like self-aggrandizement to me.
I think you're right. I think that was his primary aim, because he understood that the French kings had used art and architecture to build the image of their political power. But the interesting thing was that all these works were going to the Louvre, and the Louvre was a public museum of art. It had been only in 1793, 3 years before this Italian campaign. Under the Reign of Terror, the revolutionaries had taken it over, and they turned the palace of the French kings into a museum of art, and they had taken the collection of the French kings and put that collection in the museum. So it was really a symbol of the French Republic, and its purpose was education and conservation. So by putting this plundered art in the museum, he really helped legitimize it, and also, I think, legitimize his reign, because great collections of art were attributes of all the sovereigns of Europe, in particular the French kings.
Have you been able to trace the pushback? I would imagine the pushback coming first and foremost from out of Italy, from out of Venice. Have you been able to trace how the atmosphere about this whole story has changed over time, over the decades? I would imagine that there could have been a very persistent sense of this has got to go back. I understand that today, by the way, that the fragility of this artwork almost precludes transporting it anywhere, and maybe you can comment on that too.
Well, that's a difficult question, and I don't know, because the French, even though that was their argument in 1815, and certainly would have been, their transporting it to France was incredibly risky. They had wrapped it around a cylinder and put four other paintings over it, and yet the French have moved it twice. When Paris itself was under threat, first in the Franco-Prussian War and then during the Second World War, when it went to six different chateaus in France.
Yeah, so it's been moved.
And it's interestingly, there was a protest from the French when the French government decided to take these, when Napoleon took these works of art from Rome, 100 works of art, these antiquities of Rome were considered the greatest works of art in the 18th century. All art students of art, all artists had to study them. And there was a protest written by a connoisseur in France, signed by 50 artists, saying, don't take them, and because it is Rome that is the true museum. It's interesting that once these works of art did arrive in Paris and were put on display at the Louvre, that protest was quieted.
Yeah, it was too good to be true.
Well, people were dazzled, and the French artists took great advantage of having all these works of art there.
What about ongoing protests, even up to our day? Is this an active dialogue that's happening, or is it just a foregone conclusion that this famed scene is now at the Louvre to stay put?
It's interesting. It's not that I'm aware of that it has been an active protest. In the 1950s, the head of San Giorgio Maggiore apparently talked to André Malraux, who is French cultural minister, they talked about the painting. And Malraux said, no, it's politically impossible to get it back. And I think what's so interesting is that the Cini Foundation, this is the head of the Cini Foundation that owns San Giorgio Maggiore is the person. They are the ones who talked to Malraux. And when they did this digital reproduction and put it on the end wall of the refectory, in a way, to me, it sidesteps the issue of restitution. And, of course, in Napoleon's time, it wasn't against the international law. There was no international law prohibiting plunder the way there was, you know, starting in 1899 with the Hague Convention was the first time that plunder was prohibited.
Well, plunder is such a strong word and sometimes a very accurate word. I know that your job as somebody who tells this story is not necessarily to weigh in with your own feelings or emotions about it. I'm just wondering if this whole story doesn't make you wince. Is there part of you where this is just – I know you can sleep at night because it is what it is and it's probably in France to stay. Do you have any personal reaction? Is there something deep inside you that says, wow, a terrible wrong was committed here?
Well, what I loved about the story was the contradictions in the story. And I think it should have gone back in 1815, but the painting has had an incredible history in France. It was very many French artists, the greatest French artists of their time, Antoine Gros, David, the great colorist Delacroix, later Cézanne copied figures in this painting. Van Gogh wrote about the painting to his brother Theo. So it's had an amazing history in the Louvre. So that's what I think is so fascinating is the story, the complications of the story.
Is my reaction to the idea that I'm not going to hang on to this forever and think that we've got a right or wrong here, but there's part of me that just winces. It's just so unsavory, this whole story of the feast at Cana.
Well, certainly plunder is a terrible thing, and it was a terrible thing that he did this. But I still think it's had a fantastic history in France, and it's become a very important part of certainly of the Louvre and of French culture. So that's what I thought is so, you know, I really wanted to tell that story and explain that I loved, you know, thinking about the transfer of art and the movement of art and how art means different things to different people and has different purposes. People use it for different purposes.
Last of all, it just seems to me that if there is anything that ameliorates the story for me, it just seems to me that the Louvre is a place full of competent people who are taking care of it quite well.
Yes, I'd say that's true.
I mean, Venice, there's humidity in the air down there, and it's a city that's sinking. And so at one level, I'm just thinking, well, maybe it's better off in France.
Well, it's done well in France. And it's interesting, they had another Veronese feast that was taken by Napoleon, and it was returned to Venice, and it didn't go back to the refectory for which it was painted. It went back to a museum, which was, it's the Accademia, a museum that was started under when Napoleon was in charge of Venice and in some ways inspired by the Louvre. And you asked, one of the most interesting things was that there was a conservator in Venice, a restorer, who had been in charge of all the paintings in Venice, and he had been assigned, his name is Pietro Edwards. He was assigned to help the French pack up the paintings. And some of the most eloquent protests really came from letters that are in the Venetian State Archives written by him explaining how painful it was for him to do this, to pack up the paintings for France. And yet in these letters, he says also, Venice should establish its own museum on the model of the Louvre.
I'm not going to let you go before you make one more comment for us, if you would, kindly, about the Mona Lisa staring this painting from across the gallery. People don't go to that place first and foremost to see the Veronese, do they?
No, they don't. And people have confessed to me that they've seen the Mona Lisa and they didn't notice this painting. And my advice is go early in the morning, go late in the day, you can see it. What's also fascinating is that the German playwright Friedrich Schiller, in the 18th century, he complained that the painting, when it was in the refectory, was too, he called it, he said, it's way, way difficult to see. It's way off in a monkish refectory. Then it comes to the Louvre, And he complains that the French are vandals and they have taken all the stuff from Italy, and they can't, they won't, that they've, by taking the stuff from Italy, they have made it impossible for themselves to see it anymore, that they have alienated themselves from these great works of art. That's so interesting. And yet today, it's the, you know, one of the most accessible paintings because 8 million people or something come to see the Mona Lisa every year. And yet it's very difficult to see because it's so crowded.
Yeah, it's crowded. On the other hand, they could just turn around and they'd be in the minority looking the other way, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would. But they wouldn't. They would have an incredible experience. So they definitely should.
Cynthia Saltzman, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's been a great pleasure.
Cynthia Saltzman with us. She is formerly a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, winner of a 2017 Guggenheim Fellowship, and her new book is titled Plunder, Napoleon's Theft of Veronese's Feast. Turns out that Napoleon didn't just steal Italian paintings. We're going to take a break and then hear a story of another of his favorite infamous wartime acquisitions. This one may surprise you. Comes from Egypt. There's a little hint for you. Next on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Napoleon Bonaparte was one of the world's greatest art thieves. Actually, if you've ever wondered how that hand got stuck in his vest, it probably was on account of sticky fingers. But paintings weren't the only kind of artifacts, artworks, that he coveted. When his forces from France invaded Egypt in 1798, they began a fad of stealing all sorts of stuff, and in Egypt that would mean antiquities, including the most improbable of all things, barring maybe stealing a sphinx or a pyramid and taking that home. I'm talking about the massive obelisks. Were they really stolen, or were they gifts to France from Egypt? I wanted to learn more, and I spoke about it with Bob Breyer, Senior Research Fellow at Long Island University. He's author of Cleopatra's Needles, The Lost Obelisks of Egypt. We got going talking about where the name obelisk came from in the first place.
Well, actually, when the Greeks came into Egypt, they saw these obelisks, and they said, gee, that looks like our shish kebab skewers. So they called them obeliscus, which is your meat skewer.
Now, you said obeliscus, and then a moment ago you said obelisk. Do you happen to have a preference?
Well, in English, I tend to say obelisk, yeah.
Yeah. You've heard both, though. It's all
oh,
good.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, these obelisks that you're talking about that are lost, you don't mean lost and gone forever, but lost to Egypt, right?
Yeah. My book is primarily about the three obelisks that left Egypt in the 19th century, but there are, of course, a lot in Rome also. But I really talk most about those three. So they're lost to Egypt, not disappeared.
And this theft, as it happens, or were they acquired fairly? Were they purchased?
No, neither, actually. It's not a theft, and they weren't purchased. They were gifts. In the 19th century, the Egyptian government was currying favor with European powers because they wanted to modernize Egypt. And the ruler, Muhammad Ali, was giving away antiquities left and right and center, and he gave away obelisks.
That's kind of strange. I don't think that practice happens very often nowadays, does it?
No, not anymore. Nothing leaves Egypt. No antiquities leave Egypt. But, you know, Muhammad Ali was actually Albanian. He wasn't an Egyptian. The Turks were sort of controlling Egypt. And Muhammad Ali didn't view it as any kind of patrimony or anything. He was just giving them away.
Wow. Now, if you give away an obelisk, who's responsible for hauling it out? Because those are heavy things.
Shipping wasn't included, Marcus. so you had to get your own. And three big ones left in the 19th century. The first one to leave was the Paris obelisk. It left around 1832. And it wasn't easy. None of the obelisks came over easily. Each one has a tremendous story. Every one of them was fraught with adventure. Some men lost lives bringing them over. So they're all great stories.
How do you even do that? Well, you know what? Let's go back to square one. Before we transport one, let's make one, shall we?
Sure.
How do you even make – when I think about Stonehenge, or if I think about the Great Pyramids, I'm always just scratching my head thinking that it was possible.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I've thought about a lot is, you know, as Egyptologists, we talk all the time about what's the most amazing thing the Egyptians ever did. You know, and there's plenty of things that come to mind, like the Great Pyramid, like you suggest, or maybe even Tutankhamun's gold mask, or maybe Karnak Temple. But for me, it's a no-brainer. It's the obelisks. They are the most remarkable productions in Egypt, I think. They're made out of a single piece of stone, as you said in your introduction. They're all granite. They're all made out of the same stone. They all came from the same quarry at Aswan, the granite quarry, because it's the only stone strong enough to support its weight. Otherwise, if you tried to make a big obelisk out of, say, limestone, it would just crack. You can't have a stone that big out of limestone. So these things are really big and really hard. Granite is really hard. So when they quarried them, and you're asking me, how do you make one? When they quarried them, believe it or not, don't think about guys chiseling them out of the quarry. They didn't have chisels hard enough to chisel granite. They had copper, they had bronze, but that won't work on granite. So they're actually pounded out of the quarry with other stones that are slightly harder than granite. So you imagine these guys, probably prisoners, lined up along an obelisk that's sort of drawn on the bottom of the quarry face, and you're just pounding away with stones all day long.
Now, what stones in particular? I don't know where are they getting these from.
Well, they occur in Egypt also. They're called dolerite, and it's slightly harder than granite. So they use things that are about you know, sort of like a bowling ball. Imagine a bowling ball. You keep dropping it and dropping it and dropping it, and it chips away till you got your rough quarry outline. And it takes a long time. I mean, by long, we've done experiments to see how long does it take to do an obelisk, and if you're dropping this bowling ball on your granite, you go at the rate of about a quarter of an inch an hour. So every 4 hours, you get an inch.
So these things aren't chiseled out. They're kind of pummeled out.
Yeah, they're pounded out. That's right. And then to get the really fine polish, they use a kind of slurry. They use like a sandpaper made out of sand and water, and you just sand it down.
Now, as this is being taken from the quarry, I understand it's horizontal to begin with, right?
Exactly, right.
And so you have to – I'm just trying to imagine this.
Yeah, yes.
You would go down – you'd have to make a couple of trenches on either side of the intended obelisk.
Exactly. You're envisioning it right. Now you're going to come to a problem, right, Marcus?
Yeah, I don't know how to get under it.
Yeah, how do you get under it? Well, I think the answer there, you're right, it's the hard part. It's still fixed to the bottom of the quarry. You may have an obelisk free on three sides, but you got to get that bottom part free. What they did is they tunneled under it. They had the same dolerite ball, and they're pounding only horizontally, which is much harder, and they're pounding sideways. And what they do is they form a little tunnel under the future obelisk, and then they fill that tunnel with a granite block. So it's supported on the granite block, and then you make another tunnel next to it, supported on a granite block, and eventually you get the thing resting on granite blocks. Not easy.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten to the part. You've talked about polishing it. I don't know. I mean, that would take time too. But then you got to get the thing moved to where it's supposed to go and upright.
Yes, that's right. And that's basically a lot of guys on ropes. They're just hauling it on rollers. You have logs, basically, and guys on ropes pulling it down to the river so they can put it on a barge so they can get it to the temple where they want to erect it. And, you know, that's the average obelisk. That's maybe an average obelisk, say, maybe weighs 250 tons, right? But there's one obelisk in the quarry still. It's called the unfinished obelisk because it wasn't completed. It cracked while they were making it, you know, and it's the largest obelisk ever attempted. And it's an order of magnitude larger than anything we've ever seen. It's 1,000 tons. It weighs about as much as two jumbo jets.
Well, is this obelisk that's lying there unfinished, it's still attached to the quarry, it never got removed?
Exactly.
And did they do any polishing on it, or is it still in its rough-hewn state?
It's not terribly rough. No. It's pretty good. You look at it and you say, oh, there's the obelisk. I mean, it's pretty clear. They've done some polishing on it, but before they could free it from the bottom, the thing cracked, and then they tried to cut it down to make it a little smaller, and it cracked again. So there were basic flaws within the stone. You know, you can just imagine the moment where one guy says to the other, no, you tell the Pharaoh. No, you tell the Pharaoh.
I was going to say, that was not a good day.
No.
Oh, my. So I would imagine, though, that residual broken relic of the past. That thing is kind of the key to how they were made.
Yes, yes. We really can look at it and get an idea. Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about their function, their purpose. You've already kind of gotten into transporting them by a barge, and that seems improbable to me too. But what are they for?
Well, they always came in pairs, and they were erected in front of temples, and they're inscribed with hieroglyphs. And the hieroglyphs don't tell us anything interesting ever. What they are is the pharaoh's name. And basically, the obelisks are telling you, I, the pharaoh Ramses the Great, built this temple that you're now entering. So you enter the temple between the two obelisks, through the doorway, and the obelisks are proclaiming who built the temple.
It's just the byline. It's the credit. Somebody's got to get credit for it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And so they're ornamental in function. There's nothing mysterious about them. I mean, I've heard stories over the years about, you know, they're either special charms or incantations or religious function.
No, not really. They are always associated with the sun because the tips of the obelisks sort of get the rays of the sun first, but that's about it. They didn't have any mysterious function, no. They're really, like you say, kind of labels.
Well, one of the things I like about them is the tip, because there's the pyramidal shape to the tip, and that is very, I mean, if you're a designer, you got a motive, and there you go. You've got your big pyramids, and even the obelisks have got their pyramids.
Yeah, every obelisk has a little pyramid at the top. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It is.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's go back to the barge thing if we can.
Yes.
whoever thought that up was either a genius or a fool, because you know, the stone could sink. You've got to make quite a barge.
Yeah, it's a really big barge. And I'll tell you something that shocked me. We don't have many ancient accounts of how they did obelisks, but Queen Hatshepsut quarried two obelisks, a pair, like everybody else, and she, on her temple, put a depiction of them towing the obelisk to the temple. And it's really cool because what she did was, you know, you say you have to make a pretty big barge. She put two obelisks end to end on one barge. Not the way I would have done it, you know, talk about all your eggs in one basket. But she has two obelisks end-to-end, and she shows the obelisk being towed by 23 boats. There's small boats attached to it, and it's going down the Nile.
You know, just as awe-inspiring as the thing itself is the idea that this thing, I can only imagine the spectators watching that happen. That would have been a day. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you know, it would be bumper-to-bumper traffic to see that kind of a thing happening.
Yeah, I bet people line the Nile, like you suggest, watching Queen Hatshepsut's obelisk come down the Nile. You know, it's really impressive. But, you know, there was something similar that I've thought about. You know, New York has an obelisk. The three obelisks that left in the 19th century were Paris, London, and New York in that order. Well, New York got its obelisk in 1881, and it came off the Hudson River, and the obelisk was brought through the city streets of New York. And imagine if you were a kid in 1881 and it's coming down your block. I mean, that must have been really incredible. You never forget that.
Yeah, it's surreal because obelisks with hieroglyphs on them, that doesn't belong in a place like the New World, really.
Yeah, no. It must have been great on the west side of New York or something like that. It's just really cool.
Now, there are let's come to modern days and talk about these three needles, these Cleopatra's needles. You say
sure.
London, Paris, New York. They are gifts. These happened in the 1800s, the earliest one in the early, you say 1831-ish or so?
Yeah, 32-ish, yeah. You're about right.
And then 1880s for the New York City. That's a long stretch of time.
Yeah.
Is this kind of like getting a trophy or something?
Well, it is a little bit in the sense that once the French got their obelisk in the 1830s, the other major cities just had obelisk envy, and they had to have one. But like you say, it took a while for them to get theirs after Paris got theirs because it was so hard doing it. Everybody was afraid to try to pick it up. You know, Muhammad Ali had given them the obelisk, but they had to come and get it, and everybody was afraid to do it. And even when the French did it, they wanted an obelisk, but they just didn't have the guts to pick it up.
When it finally does move, though, tell us the story about when the Nile goes low, the seasonal, and then it has to be in its high flood stage to be able to even navigate the river, and that complicated the transport.
Yeah, the French took about 3 years to move their obelisk. It took them 3 years from the time they show up in Egypt to the time they erect it on the Place de la Concorde in Paris, And one of the reasons was that they had a special ship built that the obelisk would fit in that could navigate the Nile, because it's only a river. It's, you know, they're going down a river. So it's a special boat that's got called the Luxor, and they get the obelisk, you know, in the boat, but they've got to wait for a high Nile so it'll float off the bank of the Nile. And they're waiting months, you know, so they went on a tour of Egypt, you know, they're waiting for the Nile to rise, and it didn't, and, you know, some years the Nile doesn't rise high enough, and they were a little worried. It was getting close, and the thing wasn't high enough, but finally, the Luxor, the ship, floated up, and they went up the Nile. So, you know, they had to wait for the Nile and navigate and wait for weather. You know, you couldn't set it off on the Atlantic, you know, for example, or whatever, because bad weather. So it took months and months and months of waiting before they could get it on the ocean.
What's the story about burying the boat, though, under desert sand?
Oh, you know, when the French came with their boat, they decided to ground the boat. They would sail the boat right into the bank at right angles, so that they could get the obelisk on it easily. They wouldn't have to maneuver it too much. So they ground their boat on the bank of the Nile. They get the obelisk in, right? And then they're going to wait 6 months or so for the Nile to rise. But they're afraid that the sun is going to crack the planks on the boat, because it's summer, it's hot as hell, you know, and they're afraid. So they buried it in sand, and they put mats on it, reed mats, and they watered their boat. They had the locals come and water it every day, pour Nile water on it, so that it would keep it wet, so the wood wouldn't crack. You know, there was all kinds of problems they had with their obelisk, the French. You know, it wasn't easy. Nobody had an easy time bringing an obelisk back.
Now, these three that you mentioned, are they the only three obelisks to have left Egypt, or have other countries elsewhere gotten their hands on some?
Well, it's in modern times, since the 19th century, that they're the only ones. But you have Rome, which has 13 obelisks. But Rome's obelisks were brought over as trophies of war. The Romans had conquered Egypt, and the emperors were bringing back these obelisks as trophies.
So those in Rome are not facsimiles. They're not knockoffs.
No, they're the real deal. They're the real deal.
And so in ancient times, they were taking barges and boats down to the Nile and going across the Mediterranean?
Yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, you know, Caligula brought one. And the boat that brought it was specially built. The barge was specially built to bring it. And they thought it was such a great accomplishment that the barge was on exhibit for years, you know, just as a kind of thing of wonder. Yeah, no, the Romans brought them over, and, you know, pretty impressive. So when you walk through Rome, those are the real deal.
Bob, I'm fascinated by the tale of transporting one of these in basically a cylindrical sleeve of iron on a boat or dragged behind the boat.
Yeah, it was towed. It's the London Obelisk. And when they went to pick up their obelisk, their plan, and this is 1878, London is getting their obelisk. And their plan is to build what they called a caisson out of iron. It looks like a kind of the cigar tubes that fancy cigars come in. And so they build this big caisson, and they put their obelisk in it, and the caisson is going to be towed by a steamship. And this is the one that really ended in tragedy. So they've got the obelisk in their caisson, and they're going to sail it across to England, and the steamship is towing it. And on this caisson, there is a crew of three guys. They are inside the caisson. There's a way they can get out. There's a hatch they can get up. And they're communicating with the steamship by big chalkboard, like, that says, you can go faster or slow down. And they're communicating. But then they hit a hurricane. They were in the ocean at the Bay of Biscay, and they hit a hurricane. And it looked like the obelisk was going to sink. So they had to cut it free, but first they had to get the guys off the caisson, the three men who were on the caisson. So five brave men on the steamship volunteered to be lowered in a rowboat in a hurricane and row themselves over to the caisson to get these guys off. And as they're nearing the caisson, a huge wave comes, crashes down on the rowboat, and these five guys died. They were never seen again. So now you've lost five guys, you've still got the caisson, which looks like it's going to sink, and you've got three guys on that. Finally, the steamer gets around and throws a rope to the caisson and pulls the guys on board, and then they cut the caisson free. And the next day, after the hurricane subsided, they went back to see if they could find the caisson, and it was gone. The obelisk had sunk, they were pretty sure. They were wrong, fortunately. The Oblast was just sort of floating somewhere, and the next day, a steamship came along, saw it, knew what it was. Everybody was reading the newspaper accounts of London getting their obelisk, and they claimed it as salvage by the laws of the sea. They now owned the obelisk.
So slow down just a bit. The laws of the sea, what are you talking about there?
Well, salvage. If you find something on the sea that's been abandoned, it's yours.
Well, looky here. We just found us an obelisk.
Exactly. So they've got this obelisk, and they tow it to safety. They get a line on it. They tow it to a port, and they own the obelisk. So now the Brits have to negotiate, or actually the insurance company, has to negotiate to buy this obelisk from them. And there's this court case, which is a lot of fun, because the Brits say, you know, the court is going to decide what the obelisk is worth, and therefore what the Brits are going to have to pay for it. And the Brits are claiming, well, it's just a piece of stone. Let's figure out how much the granite costs. And the people who found the obelisk are saying, well, I think most of the capitals of Europe would pay quite a bit for an obelisk. So finally, they had to pay £3,000 sterling in 1878 to get their obelisk back. But that's how they got their London obelisk.
So when this finally arrives in London, it doesn't immediately go to its final destination, does it?
No. You know, Marcus, that is one of the things that always puzzles me about these smart guys who are moving obelisks and plan so well. All three obelisks, the Paris, the London, the New York, when they were towing their obelisks back to their cities, they still hadn't decided where it was going to go. I mean, why wait that long? So the London obelisk, when they get it to London, they don't know where it's going to go. Nobody knows where to put it. So they build a model obelisk, the same size as the obelisk, 87 feet high, out of wood. And they're dragging it through the streets of London, erecting it in various places. You're like, what do you think about here, Harry? What do you think about here? You know? And they bring it around. So finally, they put it on the Thames by the river, because that's really where it belongs, because that's where it was. You know, it was in Alexandria, and it was by the Nile, so they thought it should go there.
Bob Breyer is Senior Research Fellow at Long Island University. He's author of Cleopatra's Needles, The Lost Obelisks of Egypt. Tomorrow on Constant Wonder, another field trip to the ancient world of the Mediterranean. We're going to be talking about a tragedy more horrific than a few pilfered obelisks. Ever hear of Pompeii or Vesuvius? You know, the people who lived at the foot of that volcano were considered for years to be more decadent than their neighbors. Some philosophers even suggested that they got what they deserved. Can that really even be true? A comeuppance by cataclysm. We're going to examine the days leading up to the eruption of Vesuvius. That's on the show tomorrow. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.